Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ojachowski and I am your host for today. On today's program, we have a couple of different guests, actually. It's a bit of a packed show. We're going to be speaking with two very different guests about two very different topics. First up, we're going to be speaking with Elizabeth Scholes, who lives in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, and we're going to be speaking with her somewhat generally about the state of animal protection in Prince Edward Island. But specifically, we're going to be talking to her about a couple of issues. Firstly, we're going to be talking about the City of Charlottetown's wildlife removal program that they have in place right now currently to get rid of skunks in the Charlottetown city limits. And we're also going to be talking about the emergence and recent shutdown of a couple of puppy mills in the province of Prince Edward Island, which is something that you might not necessarily think was happening there. It's a fairly small place, not exactly populated in the same way that provinces like Quebec and Ontario are. But puppy mills do indeed exist there, and it's just as awful as you might expect it to be anywhere else. So we're going to be speaking with Elizabeth Scholes first. And after that, we're going to be speaking with, personally, one of my favorite guests, Will Potter. Will Potter is a seasoned journalist and blogger who writes for his own website, greenisthenewred.com, but he also has been doing journalism for a very long time and has contributed some amazing work to journalism in general in the U.S. So we're going to be speaking with him about a bit of an update with the Shack 7, the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty 7. There were seven activists who were convicted and sentenced to varying jail terms for their participation in a campaign against Huntington Life Sciences, where animals are tested on for all sorts of frivolous things like cosmetics and food items. So we're going to be speaking with him at the a bit later in the hour, about halfway through, and he's going to give us an update on the Shack 7 because they have actually just recently in the past week had their convictions upheld. And though, you know, many convictions here and there are upheld throughout the land all the time, this one is particularly significant and holds a lot of weight for anyone who's interested in doing animal activism. This is definitely a show to listen to. So, those are our two guests. Now we're going to do an interview with our friend in PEI, Elizabeth Scholes. Elizabeth is an activist with the Cat Action Team in Prince Edward Island, and she's here today to talk to us about a little bit about that, but mostly about a couple of other issues happening in Prince Edward Island right now. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Not a problem. Maybe you could just give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself. Tell us a bit about who you are and how you got into animal issues.
Well, my actual career training, I suppose, is in history. I did a PhD in history, and the thought, I guess, was that I would go on to teaching, but I have to say my heart was never really in it. I didn't feel like I was doing really any great good for the world, and my thoughts always went back to animals. And I finally decided that's where I wanted to put my efforts. So I gradually started getting involved in a few local things. I'm actually from Toronto, and I started getting involved there in lobbying for the federal act to amend the criminal code concerning cruelty to animals in, I guess, about 10 years ago. And it just went from there, and I started getting involved in more mainly political issues. And then when I moved down here to PEI about 4 years ago, started trying to familiarize myself with provincial problems, and have since we moved here, trying to been getting more involved in that and getting in touch with politicians and trying to get some things changed.
And so what kind of activism do you do in PEI? You mentioned to me over email that you are a member of the Cat Action Team. So
I am, yeah.
Tell us a bit about them and what you do with them.
Cat Action Team is it's the only trap, neuter, release program in PEI. So we deal with feral, stray, and barn cats. Feral and stray cat overpopulation is a huge problem everywhere. So it's a small volunteer group struggling along to try and deal with the problem with no government support, which is pretty standard for groups like that. I guess what I would call my activist work is more outside of that. It's my own personal efforts. So I don't, what I do there, I don't really do on behalf of the organizations that I belong to here. But gradually the animal welfare organizations in PEI are getting a little bit more activist. They tend to be rather reticent in getting out there and speaking out loud. So kind of trying to, you know, put a little fire under them as well.
And so how would you describe the sort of state of the state for animals in PEI?
I'd say it's pretty grim, to be honest, and I don't think I'm the only one. It's a small, rural, traditional province, and ideas about animals that go along with that. And it's changing a little bit, but animals are viewed here largely, I would say, as agricultural product, not as sentient beings with their own interests. So it's, there's not really, what animal legislation exists here is more how to govern the use of animals rather than actually providing protection to animals.
Right. I invited you on the show, and you actually contacted the program specifically to tell us about the wildlife removal program by the city of Charlottetown. And this is especially affecting skunks, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's, there is other wildlife in Charlottetown and other towns, but the main issue seems to be around skunks.
No, that's okay. Maybe you could sort of give us an overview about sort of when this removal program started and how long it's been in place and what exactly it involves.
Well, the City Council of Charlottetown contracts out to a company, and they've been contracting to the same company for about 15 years now, and I'm not even aware that there was a policy before that, but certainly the company that's doing right now has been in place for about 15 years. And it's actually it's a lawn care and pest control. It's not a wildlife management company. It's a local lawn care company. And when people call in to the city complaining about skunks on their property, they send this company out to deal with the problem. And I recently, I guess maybe a couple of months ago, discovered that by calling city council, found out that what this company was actually doing was trapping them, taking them away, and then shooting them and killing them. And there had been no nothing from the politicians or anybody to indicate to the public that this is what they were doing with these animals.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of what the financial investment in this program has been?
Well, according to the city councilor who is in charge of this, he's the chair of the Public Works Committee, and this all falls under the Public Works Department, so that might give you an idea of how they view it. It's lumped in there with road repair and snow removal.
Right.
It doesn't come under environment. And the city councilor, Terry Bernard, who's the chair of this committee, has said that right now I think the contract is for $11,000 a year. And it's just lumped in as part of the larger public works budget.
I'm sure many people would understand on some level why, you know, they don't want to go near skunks. And that's fair enough because, you know, I don't want to go near a skunk in case I get sprayed as well.
Yeah.
I'm curious, for an $11,000 a year program, I'm really curious to know why animals are being removed for that much money and from where? Is there a sort of skunk overpopulation problem? Is this, I guess it the scope of it seems off.
It does, yeah. And a large part of the problem, I would say, is that nobody's really thought about this. When I first contacted Councillor Bernard about this, he said he had no idea that this is what the company was doing. He thought they were just removing them and relocating them. And when I contacted other councillors, they professed the same thing, to say they had no idea. Ironically, one of the councillors is the wife of the owner of this lawn care company. So it's kind of hard to believe they didn't know what
they
was
must
going on. But anyway,
not necessarily a dinner table conversation.
Not really, but you would think as they talk about the contract in council every year, at some point it would have come up what exactly it is they were paying this company to do. But as far as what is the actual wildlife situation, they said that this past summer they trapped and killed about 400 skunks.
Wow.
In Charlottetown.
And so this is within the city limits? Are these in residential neighborhoods? Is this on publicly owned land? I'm just trying to imagine what how the city is paying this group without really knowing what they're doing, and what is the mandate? Are they to go on into public parks and do this removal? Is it people who call them and ask them to remove this, and then the city pays the bills?
Well, as far as I understand, it's people who contact them. I'm not aware that they actually go out and seek animals to trap and shoot. I think they have to get a call for it, but I'm not sure about that. Ironically, another thing that the Charlottetown City Council does is they promote preserving natural woodlands within Charlottetown. Right. So I don't know who they think is going to be living in these woodlands that they're seeking to promote. You can't have one without the other.
Right.
So they preserve the woodlands to attract the animals, and then they kill the animals when they show up. It just doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Is there a skunk overpopulation problem?
I would say that's subjective.
Right.
The company doing the trapping says that 400 is a problem. But the way I look at it is, if they've been getting paid for the past 15 years to do this, and they're complaining that there's an overpopulation, then they haven't been doing a very good job for the past 15
right.
years. What are they getting paid for? And through my involvement with the Cat Action Team and getting to know more about trap, neuter, release programs for domestic animals, trapping and killing just doesn't work. It doesn't bring down the overpopulation. Animals will just move in to take their place, and the methods that they're using are just, aside from being inhumane, they just don't work, whether it's a cat or a skunk or whatever animal. It just doesn't solve the problem.
So maybe let's talk a little bit about how the animals in question, I guess we're specifically talking about skunks, but I'm guessing that there are some other animals who fall under this program. How are the animals trapped specifically, and how are they removed and treated once they're trapped?
Well, I have seen some of the box traps that they use around Charlottetown that they set out for skunks.
And there are some photos of these online.
There are, yeah.
I believe on the CBC website. We'll post links to some of the articles that you passed along to me.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, there's a shot on there of the standard type of box trap that they use. As far as how they do it, they've been very reticent to talk about that, and I spent a few months trying to get somebody to explain to me specifically what they're doing, and I got put off by quite a lot of people in the municipal government and talking to the company who does it. They just didn't want to admit fully what they were doing and give me the details.
Mm-hmm.
What they say they're doing is following the guidelines set by PEI's Provincial Ministry of the Environment, and that's even, to be honest, even more frightening, because the Ministry of the Environment has a brochure on their website about how to handle skunks, one for raccoons and one for foxes. And the one for skunks recommends trapping them and either drowning them or chloroforming them while in the trap.
And so this is advice that they're giving to private citizens.
To private citizens, and these are the guidelines that they lay out for the companies that are then hired by every level of government to handle wildlife.
And so the company that's doing this wildlife removal, are they chloroforming and drowning skunks as well? Or as far as you know, they're shooting them?
As far as I know, nobody's actually confessed to doing anything other than shooting. When this issue first came out in the local media here a couple of weeks ago, a representative from the Ministry of Wildlife was questioned about this brochure concerning handling of skunks. And, he said that that had been revised about 5 years ago, and they just hadn't got around to putting up the new brochure on their website. But the new brochure, all it really does is take out the word drowning. It's still
right.
pretty much the same.
And does it still also recommend chloroforming?
It does, yeah.
Okay. What do you propose as an alternative to this program? Do you propose an alternative, or do you just see it as sort of a non-issue?
I think it's a big issue. It's not just in terms of specifically what is happening to skunks in Charlottetown. I think the bigger issue here is, how do people in this province view animals, and what is their place in our world here? And I think this episode and few other ones I've been involved in really highlight how people here see animals. They just see them as either farm product or a nuisance to be got rid of in whatever is the cheapest and easiest method. And I think that really needs to change.
Do you see this issue changing in a meaningful way? You've been working on this for a while. You've been writing you've been writing letters, and you've obviously been making some phone calls, and there has been press coverage generated based on some of the work you've done. And I guess you, maybe more than anyone at this point, would have a sense of whether whether there is some will to sort of change things.
The sense I get is that there is a growing will. As I say, I've only actually been living in the province for 4 years, so I'm still learning a lot as well about how people think and why they think the way they do. It's something that I certainly have to learn about, having grown up in Toronto, and my relationship with wildlife was the raccoons in my chimney. So it's a very different, obviously it's a very different culture. And
although probably somewhat the same in many ways.
I guess it is. I guess no matter what, where you live, you get attitudes on both sides. People just seeing animals as generally a pest that has no place on the earth dominated by humans. And then other people who want to emphasize that every species is here and every species has the right to do what that species does, aside from humans going around removing the rest of them.
Right.
But because it's a predominantly agricultural area, it really does influence how people see animals. And that is starting to change. And talking to people who have been here for a long time and who have tried to get changes in legislation and who have tried to get politicians to listen, they say also that they are starting to see a shift, that people are starting to think a little bit beyond just whether somebody's digging a hole in their lawn, to the wider issue of humane treatment and animal welfare, and that animals have just as much of a right to be here as we do. So I guess the short answer to your question is yes, I think I am sensing that things are changing.
Do you sense this issue in particular, because you've spoken directly with some of the people involved in maintaining and running this wildlife removal program, do you sense this issue, is there any traction on this issue, and are things shifting around?
I think we'll have to wait and see about this particular issue. City Council did not want to have to deal with this, and they complained and dragged their feet. And then when it was in the media here, they were forced to at least discuss it, and they decided apparently that they were not going to change what this particular company they were contracting. They were not going to make any changes to that, and as far as they were concerned, it was a non-issue. They didn't really care what happened to the animals. Those kind of public comments, I think, are helping to motivate the public and make them see that these politicians really need to change how they think. So I think the more that these kinds of things can come out in the media and in whatever public forum is available, the more it's going to be clear what the politicians' views are, and then that gives the public something to react to.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about the other issue that we went back and forth with a bit about over email. And I read stories about animal abuse every week to put this show together and to sort of get a sense of what's happening. And I was surprised to read about the closing down of puppiesacrosscanada.com,
right,
which is a website that was it based out of Prince Edward Island?
As far as I know, actually, if you go to that address, puppiesacrosscanada.com, you see the account has been suspended.
Right.
And nobody's actually at the moment admitting to having done that. So a lot of things are up in the air about this right now.
Okay. Maybe you could tell us a bit about what puppiesacrosscanada.com was, what happened recently with them, and why it was significant.
Well, what it is, I suppose, in theory, is an online pet store. What people here would call it would be a puppy mill. And it's a company that has actually been in business for a few years now. It was previously called Snookums, and Snookums was largely forced to close down because of public pressure.
And Snookums was a real pet store, a bricks and mortar kind of physical pet store.
It was, yeah. The owner, Bud Wheatley, increasingly went towards online selling, and I think largely because of the pressure that was being put on him here. But it was a storefront business. When it shut down and reopened as Puppies Across Canada, it's pretty much entirely an online business. And in the past week or so, the Department of Agriculture here conducted a raid on the premises and removed a lot of the animals. And the account of the business has been suspended, and not much more information has been coming forward. Nobody's really explaining why the department just suddenly did this raid. They've been getting complaints about this place for years and years and years, and sending inspectors out, often several days after the complaints have been made, giving the owner, which gives the owner a chance to clean it up. So it's a bit of a mystery why this has actually happened now.
And so this is the website Puppies Across Canada had obviously an online presence, but there was also a physical location where animals were being held, and that location was in Prince Edward Island.
That was in Prince Edward Island, and actually, speaking about the media stories that are on the internet, the CBC covered this in the past week, and there's a picture of the premises of Puppies Across Canada, and it's an old house with a broken down barn next to it in the country, and that's the business.
Wow, I certainly didn't think of Prince Edward Island as being a place where puppy mills might even exist or be a problem. And I think maybe, I don't know, maybe it's the Prince Edward Island Tourism Board has done a very good job of presenting a particular image to me, but it's a very small province, and I have a hard time imagining the demand for pets being that great. Do you have any estimates on the number of puppy mills in PEI, or how many dogs might be affected by this? I know in the case of Puppies Across Canada that no numbers have come out, but it's obviously been enough to seize the animals.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how many other businesses there might be like this one. Snookums and Puppies Across Canada has certainly dominated people's attention for several years now. This has been the focus of a lot of people trying to get it shut down. There's even a Facebook page devoted to closing this business, and it's been in the press a lot. A lot of people know it. Unfortunately, not enough people have known it, because people have still been buying animals from this business. And when that happens, a lot of times the animal will be very sick and will die. Stories like this have been in the media now here for several years. Recently, a lot of these people have come together now and helped, again, move things forward on this. But there's no need for anybody to be producing animals to sell. There's one humane society in all of PEI, and like most shelters, it's underfunded, overcrowded, doing its best, but, you know, there are a lot of animals who are not going to make it because there aren't the homes for them, and yet we've got people like this producing more to sell them off, and in appalling conditions.
We're just about out of time, but I want to make sure that you get a chance to either give people some sort of food for thought on what they can do about these two issues. If you're interested in having people contact you so they can help you mobilize, or how you'd like to sort of give people an opportunity to move forward. But I wanted to turn it over to you and give you a chance to sort of let people know what they can do about these two issues in PEI.
Well, I think there's some very easy things that people can do, and that's, first of all, contact the politicians here. The provincial politicians need to know that the way things have been done in the past just are no longer acceptable, and anybody who is familiar enough with any of these issues, just write to the politicians here and let them know, whether it's provincial or municipal. And I'd certainly be happy if anybody wants to contact me as well. There's certainly strength in numbers, and we need help from outside the province as well to get them to pay attention.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Not a problem. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. We were just speaking with Elizabeth Scholes of Prince Edward Island. She is an activist in Prince Edward Island with the Cat Action Team, and also a very dedicated letter writer and question asker about all of these issues. If you'd like to find out more information to contact her, we will be posting that on our website when we post this interview shortly. In the meantime, we're going to take a short musical break, play some ads, and then we're going to speak with Will Potter, who's going to give us an update on the Shack 7. This is Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. I'm Karl Ozhahovsky, and stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We now turn to our interview with Will Potter. Will Potter is a journalist and blogger who especially writes often for his own blog, greenisthenewred.com, and he's here to talk to us today about what should be a very looked at and a very important case involving the Shack 7. Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, Carol. Thanks for having me back.
Not a problem. I want to jump sort of right into it because there's we don't have a lot of time, and it's a bit of a complicated issue. We've done lots of shows on the Shack 7 before, so I don't want to get too into the background story. I'll just refer people to our website, animalvoices.ca, if they want to learn more about that. But maybe you could give us the briefest of introductions to who the Shack 7 are and what they were convicted for.
Sure, and I apologize if I'm losing my voice. The Shack 7 were a group of animal rights activists who ran a controversial website as part of an international campaign to shut down a notorious laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences. And as part of that, they posted news of both legal and illegal actions on the website. Sometimes they posted contact information and home addresses so people can have protests at the homes of executives. And they vocally supported a very broad range of tactics, including, you know, if someone vandalized ATMs or broke a window in the campaign, they would often put that on their website and endorse it and sometimes poke fun at it very tongue-in-cheek. So it's a very controversial campaign, and they were charged with conspiring, not actually doing any of these things, legal or illegal, but conspiring to violate the Animal Enterprise Protection Act and commit animal enterprise terrorism. Now, this is only the second time that law was used. They were convicted. A couple of them are out now, and we just heard back on their appeal last week that prompted, obviously, doing this story now, that they lost their appeal in a very disturbing First Amendment ruling by the appellate court.
And so this was what I found a bit confusing. I'm certainly no law scholar. Yeah, some of them have already been to jail and served their time, but now the U.S. Appellate Court was upholding their convictions. Now, what does that mean?
Well, it means a couple things. For the defendants that are still in prison, they were hoping to get out early, obviously, and to be released. Now, for the others that have already served their time, obviously a ruling in their favor wouldn't help them reclaim those lost years of their lives. But in this case, particularly, it's really important because these activists are labeled officially by the U.S. government as terrorists. Mm-hmm. Now, that has had implications for them while they're in prison. It's affected how they've been treated, how they've been detained, and what type of facilities they've been in. And it's also a label that's going to be following them the rest of their lives. You know, it's the most powerful word we have right now to label somebody a terrorist or as committing terrorism. And so there's a lot on the line in this appeal, and that these defendants didn't want to be associated with the 9/11 attacks, didn't want to be labeled with the same word as Timothy McVeigh or people, abortion murderers, and people like that. And they are. Mm-hmm.
And so what does the upholding of their convictions actually mean a bit more generally?
Well, the upholding of their convictions actually has serious implications, not just for these defendants and not just for other political activists, but for everyone in this country. The ruling was incredibly disturbing in how it has gone against the body of First Amendment law in this country and taken things in a drastically new direction. And not to get too into the weeds about the specifics, but I think one of the key points of this ruling is the court determined that by the Shack 7 supporting electronic civil disobedience, such as bombarding corporate websites with emails and faxes and phone calls, And on their website, they gave instructions of how to do this and told people a certain time that they could participate in it. The court ruled that this is not First Amendment protected speech. Now, they're not accused of destroying computers or burning an internet provider or anything like that. This was just purely posting on the internet and telling people they support this tactic, and this is how they could take part, by emailing people. Now, the court ruled that's not First Amendment protected speech, and I think that has serious implications for environmental activists that are organizing mass civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. and around the country in protest of coal plants and mountaintop removal and climate change-related activity. I mean, it could wrap up a very broad range of activism in this type of a ruling.
And so what kind of effect do you think this might have on other animal rights activists? And what is this? I mean, this is obviously applying only to the U.S., but what is this actually... I have a really hard time wrapping my head around how these types of campaigns can move forward without the ability to sort of support those kind of tactics, like, you know, sort of electronic sit-ins and that sort of thing.
And with the latter part, I think that's exactly the key point here. You know, all this time, these corporations and the government have been saying that they need to go after what they call the number one domestic terrorism threat. And they say that activists who are damaging property and setting fires and things like that, who have never harmed anyone. Well, more and more, we're seeing that that's not the true motivation. They're really going after the entire animal rights and environmental movement. They're not limiting their targeting to people that are destroying property. They are constantly pushing the envelope of how far they can go. And unfortunately, in this case, the appellate court in the Shack case didn't stand up to it and didn't put a stop to them trying to expand the net and wrap up more people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and kind of relating to the first part of your question, it's hard to say the effects this is going to have. It seems to me, I've been following this for about 10 years now in all these different cases, and every time I think, oh, there's no way they're going to try to do that, there's no way the government is going to try to arrest people on terrorism charges for this, they do. In California right now, 4 animal rights activists are facing terrorism charges for having protests at researchers' homes, for chalking slogans on the sidewalk, and for chanting outside these individuals' homes. And that's it. They're not charged with breaking windows or hurting anyone or setting fires. And when you tell most people about this, they just simply don't believe you.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the reality.
And they've been charged under the new law, not the Animal Enterprises Protection Act, but the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act,
right.
Which is a new sort of strengthened version of the original, and actually uses the word terrorism in the act itself.
And uses it in the name of the title. And also, I testified before Congress about that new law, and I was roundly dismissed by members of Congress and the other witnesses who said the existing law doesn't go far enough. They also said that the new law would not target First Amendment activity. Both of those things have been a complete lie. The previous law has been upheld as being so broad it can target a website, an electronic civil disobedience. And now we have a new law that's even more broad, more vague, and is being used to go after First Amendment protected activity.
There's another case that I read about on your blog. I read your blog as often as you update it, and I wanted to maybe shift gears, if you wouldn't mind, and talk a little bit about the case of Carrie Feldman. She just appeared before a grand jury, and it's really, when I was reading this case, I felt like I was reading a Kafka novel all of a sudden. It's really because she's appearing before a grand jury and she's not even sure what's being investigated.
Right.
Could you maybe give us an overview of what this case is? Who is Carrie Feldman and why is she appearing before a grand jury in the U.S.?
Well, Carrie Feldman is a young activist. She's about 20 years old in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She was subpoenaed to a grand jury, which, you know, most people even in the U.S. aren't familiar with how grand juries work. And the very quick version is that, theoretically, every federal crime that's taken to trial is first heard before a grand jury. And they don't hear the whole case, but the government is supposed to present witnesses in the citizens on the grand jury are supposed to determine, well, is this worthy of going to trial? It's supposed to be a safeguard. How these things actually work is that they're being used against social movements, and they have been for a very long time in this country. And so when someone is subpoenaed, they often don't even know what the grand jury is about until they're starting to be questioned about it. Carrie Feldman issued a couple statements that she has reason to believe it's investigating an animal liberation front release of animals from a laboratory in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
But according to her subpoena, there's no information. So activists are then called into these rooms, and they're forced to testify. And if they don't testify about their political beliefs, about who they associate with, about what they believe about the animal rights and environmental movements, if they support illegal tactics, all these kind of things, you know, it's basically a political witch hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And if they refuse to cooperate, they face serious jail time. And that's at risk in this case, because Carrie Feldman, to her credit, has been very vocal in saying, I will not cooperate in any way with this. It's against my political values, and I won't have any part of it.
Right. She's made a statement, which you can read on your blog, greenisthenewred.com. It's a very forceful statement about her her intention to not cooperate with the grand jury. So what are the implications of this for her? What could happen to her?
It usually works something like this. You know, she will get called into the grand jury. She can either choose to go into the room or to refuse to cooperate at all. If she doesn't go in the room, there'll probably be a warrant. She'll be subpoenaed and, you know, have to go before the court and face contempt charges. If she goes before the grand jury and she refuses to testify, she can be held in contempt, and she can be thrown in jail. And sometimes what happens is the judge will put the individual in jail for, you know, a couple weeks, a month, and bring them out and try to force them to comply and use this threat of jail time to intimidate them into changing their mind and to testifying. If they don't, if they continue to refuse, they can be held in contempt of court. And then there are a lot of other avenues to go down from there. But what we've seen in the past, and there have been a few grand juries recently, is they can go on for months, if not an entire year. The length of this grand jury is a year.
Hmm.
So she can be held in jail for that entire time. And then once the grand jury ends, she can be re-subpoenaed to a new grand jury.
Wow.
So essentially, it's quite chilling how this is kind of a legal vacuum, in my opinion. The activists do not have the right to use their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
Mm-hmm.
They can't use their First Amendment right. They can't have an attorney. It's just this legal void where basic constitutional rights that
mm-hmm.
most Americans think you have all the time in the courtroom just don't apply.
To play devil's advocate, I imagine some people listening to this may think, well, if you haven't done anything wrong, quote unquote wrong, what are you afraid of, and why shouldn't you testify? Maybe you could perhaps give us your take on why non-cooperation in this is important and significant beyond a sort of, well, if you didn't do anything wrong kind of rhetoric.
Well, for a few reasons. I mean, throughout U.S. history, we've seen how these kind of fishing expeditions have been used to wrap up people in these political witch hunts, like during the Red Scare, and they're used to intimidate and instill fear in people. So they're hauling people before these courts and saying, tell us what you believe, and if you don't, we're going to throw you in jail. And if you do, the implication is clearly, we're going to try to use that against you or against the people you know. And that, in a democracy, that's not a choice anyone should have to make. The government has every right and duty to try to prosecute these crimes, to gather evidence, but they have no right to haul people before a court, demand that they name names or tell who they associate with and talk about their political beliefs and
mm-hmm.
fear that could be used against them. To do so really has a chilling effect on a democracy and makes people afraid of being vocal because they could be hauled before a grand jury. And I think that's really the intent. I mean, to link this to the Shack 7 discussion earlier, I think the overriding goal of all of this, by the prosecution and by the corporations that are really pushing a lot of these court cases, is to instill fear. In the grand jury, the biggest tool of the grand jury is to instill fear and to instill distrust. Because if Carrie Feldman had a change of heart and she decided to maybe answer a couple questions but not the rest of them, well, all of these court transcripts are sealed. Mm-hmm. So it fosters distrust among her friends and among other activists mm-hmm. who begin to wonder, well, maybe she named my name. Maybe she said something about me. Maybe I'm next. Right. And it's really meant to have a chilling effect on these groups.
There is a website that has already been set up as a support for Carrie. It's supportcarrie.wordpress.com. Can you maybe give some suggestions for our listeners about what might be good things to do to help support Carrie Feldman in this struggle, and also to sort of to help the other activists either currently facing charges or in jail because of these types of charges? There's the Shack Set, some of the members of the Shack 7 who are still in jail, the AETA 4. Do you suggest like writing letters or making donations? How can people help?
Well, I think, in my opinion, the two most important things that not just activists, but anyone listening to this can do is to first educate yourself as much as you can, because so many of these cases are completely missed by the mainstream media. Nobody has any idea of what's really going on. So check out websites like Green is the New Red and support Carrie's website and things like that, and learn as much as you can. And as part of that, on Green is the New Red right now, there's a legal guide to help activists know their rights. You know, educate yourself about what your rights are if you're visited by law enforcement or if you're subpoenaed to a grand jury or anything like that. And then the second part of it is you really need to take this information to a much wider audience. I think we really have to get beyond trying to educate other activists and other animal rights and environmental people. That I truly believe if everyday people that are not activists and are just, you know, going about their lives, if they had a clue of the extent to which this is going on right now, people would be outraged. And I think those are the most important things we can be doing to help these defendants, and to help them on a personal level, of course, write them letters, write them often, donate to their legal defense. I mean, those are very simple, fast, easy things. You can write a check in 5 minutes. You can write a letter in 10 minutes. Do that stuff every day or every week, but then also try to reach out to a broader community and educate yourself.
Well, we're just about out of time. I wanted to make sure I turned it over to you to make sure you had a chance to give a website address or any other information that you can about the work that you do. So turning it over to you.
Well, thanks, Carol. And everyone, please be sure to check out greenisthenewred.com. You can subscribe via email or RSS feed. It's updated regularly. And there's lots of resources to these cases and to other websites to learn more and to educate yourself about your rights in these other cases.
Thank you so much for being on the program, Will.
Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Will Potter. He is a blogger at greenisthenewred.com, and he's also a dedicated journalist who has been involved for years and years now with exposing some of these tribunals and grand juries and what's happening behind closed doors in courtrooms all over America, and these days happening specifically to animal rights activists. So I thank him very much for being on the program, and highly, highly recommend that you check out his website, especially if you live in the U.S. and you could potentially be affected by these issues. greenisthenewred.com. My name is Karl Ozerhovsky, and this was Animal Voices. If you have questions or comments about this program or any of our other past almost 300 archived programs, you can email us at animalvoices@gmail.com, and you can check out our website to download lots of the archive. Animalvoices.ca. Coming up next is a little bit lighter fare. Dos Mundos coming up.